Okay. So, I'm going to talk a little bit about Purim tonight. It's an interesting question. This is the only Chag, the central theme is a book. And it's interesting that we don't call it a book. We call it a Megillah, right? Megillat Esther. And there are two interesting questions. The first one is, why do we read from a Megillah? What's the difference between a Sefer and a Megillah? Okay? And you know there are a number of different halachos, but there's one specifically, okay, which is, how do you read the Megillah? Where's Harry? Harry here? Not here. Practicing Megillah. Okay, right. So, what's the most important halacha? When you read the Megillah, what do you have to do? You have to do what? You have to open it up. The whole scroll. You'll see it's written like an igaret. You read it as though it's a letter. You open up the whole thing. You fold it under itself. And you'll see it will sit here and the whole scroll will be open. We don't read it like a Sefer Torah where it's partially open and then you roll it. That's a Sefer Torah. When you open up a book, so you're open up to part of it, not the other part. But the Megillah is all open, which is what the word implies. Megillah, legalot, nigle, is the revealed, that which is wide open. But we call it Megillah Esther. Now Chazal tells us that Esther derives her name from Seter, hiddenness. So it's the revealed hiddenness. What does that mean? Number one. Number two, why do we call this the Megillah of Esther? What would you think you might want to call it? Purim, by the way, we're not going to get to this tonight. Purim is the most bizarre name for a holiday you'll ever find. What does Purim mean? What are the Purim? Lotteries. Okay, in other words, like it's all mazel. Like this is the, there's no destiny, it's all mazel, roll the dice holiday. That's a little weird. But we're not going to get to that. I got to get a little more drunk to get to that. Okay? Good, that's recorded. Good. Right? So, right? We'll get to that. Okay? When it all gets revealed. Right? But why don't we call this the Megillah of Mordechai? By the way, one of the ways that you sense what's really important is how you end something. Okay? Like if you ever listen to a good shiur or Dvar Torah, you know, I don't know, Blau gives a shiur, and he always summarizes his points at the end of his shiur. And so you get what's important. So how does the Megillah do this? The last pasuk in the Megillah, okay, the last verse in the entire story, Ki Mordechai Yehudi, Mishneh LaMelech Achashverosh, because Mordechai, the Jew, the Yehudi, the tribe of Yehuda, this is by the way the first place we find Yehudi, right? He is the assistant, he's become the viceroy, right, of Achashverosh, and Gadol Yehudi, he's a great Jewish figure. Ratzui l'rov echav, he's beloved by most of his friends, right? Of his brethren. In other words, not everybody agrees with him, but he was willing to do what he had to do. Darash tov l'amo v'dever shalom l'chol zera. And he sought good for his people and peace for everybody, etc. It's all about Mordechai, which makes sense. So where's Esther? Now, let's take a look at Esther. I want to tell you a story that I was reminded of that I can't get out of my head. It's a story that we heard, I don't know, maybe I repeated it to you since then, I apologize if I did, but we heard this story in Poland. We were in the ghetto of Lodz, and in Lodz things were a little slower. There was a Judenrat head by the name of Chaim Rumkowski, very complicated figure, seems to have cooperated with the Nazis, that created all sorts of interesting controversial questions after the war. And so what was happening elsewhere by 1942 took until 1943, but they all went up in the ovens anyway. In the summer of 1943, the Jews of Lodz were disappearing. And they were collecting them and putting them onto cattle cars and sending them first to Chelmno and later on to Auschwitz. And the Nazis were very good at leaving you one possible hope, something to grasp onto, so that you wouldn't think there was no point and maybe rebel. This is a principle. I mean, when we were in the army, they taught us that when you fight an enemy, always leave him an avenue of retreat. You never want to corner your enemy up against the wall. because then he has nowhere to run to and he has to make a last stand. You don't want your enemy to make a last stand. You want him to run. Right? So always leave a person an avenue out, a hope. And that's what they did with the Jews. Even when they were taking them to the gas chambers, they told them it was showers. They sometimes even gave them soap. So the Jews of Ludge understood that if you had a job, and the job was, you know, an important job, critical to the war effort, the factory, then you weren't deported. And even though they didn't know exactly what was going on, they knew all these trains were going somewhere and they were coming back empty. They looked around and saw who the Nazis were. They didn't think they were going to day camp. You prefer the evil you know to the one you don't know. Nobody wanted to get on those trains. They understood it wasn't good. So there was a woman, and this story was told to us by Yitzhak Rubinstein, the tour guide that we had, amazing fellow. He said there was a woman, and her husband had a young couple, I guess, and her husband had a job in a factory. He was a foreman of some work detail, which basically meant he was running a slave labor battalion, in some factory that was deemed important to the Nazi war effort. So they had papers that allowed them to stay in the ghetto. They weren't being deported. So she didn't have to worry about being thrown onto a cattle car for now. And she was at home with her little baby, and the baby started screaming. And she realized she had no food for her. She had no milk. You know, they were living on nothing. But she knew that there was a place that you could go to the basement and you could get some bootleg milk. You'd get some, like, black market milk and see, you know, for whatever the reason, had what to trade or barter or maybe some money. So her baby is screaming. And she knows she has to get there before the store closes because once it gets dark and the curfew comes, like, she won't be able to go out and whatever. So she runs out of the house to run to the store down the block. This basement, this secret black market sells the milk guy so that she can get some food for her baby because otherwise she'll have to go a whole other day. And she runs in there and she gets there just in time and she's able to get some milk. And she comes out and the street is full of soldiers. There are SS everywhere. And she realizes in a panic that they've closed off the blocks. And then she realizes to her horror that she's forgotten her papers at home. She ran out in her bathrobe. So she has no papers. So she needs to explain that she has papers. But the Nazis, they used every trick in the book. They imported Lithuanian SS to these Polish ghettos because they didn't want the SS to be able to communicate with the Jews. Because then they might be merciful, they might, you know, we might be able to explain. So they didn't speak any Polish. So she tried to explain, but they didn't understand her. And the truth is, even if they had understood her, I'm not too sure they would have cared. So they loaded her into the Umsteigplatz, into the central platform of everybody else. And she's talking to anybody who can listen. Please, my baby, my baby. And they don't know what she's talking about, they don't care. And the people who do understand her, the Poles, the Jews, they just figure one more Nebuch woman who probably saw her baby shot or whatever, they don't understand. It's all pandemonium, they're being loaded onto cattle cars. And as she's loaded onto the cattle car, all you can hear is her screams, my baby, my baby. And then they locked him in the cattle car. You know, he took us to the train station, some of you may remember. And we walked around the corner, and I thought we were going to a train station. I thought he was going to stop and tell us about the train station, tell us here where they were deported, and maybe we'd do some ceremony or something. And then we walk around the corner, and there's a platform, and there's cattle cars there. And one of them is open. And he says, come on. And we all get into this cattle car. And then he looks at us, and he says, they used to squeeze 120 people into this cattle car. We're about 40 people, so we're going to get into a third of this car. And I happened to be standing towards the back in the middle. And so all of a sudden, 40 of us are like crammed into the back of the cattle car. And there's like this window, and you can see out a little bit. The train isn't moving. The door's still open. But you're jammed into this cattle car. And I reached up, and I could actually touch the ceiling. That's how tight a space it was. And I suddenly had this little mini panic attack. Like, I got to get out of here. Like, this is like, I just want to get out of here. But I can't get out of here. And he's talking, and we're all surrounded. And so you say, okay, like, you can't. And that's like 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And they're stuck in this cattle car for days. And if they got squeezed in standing, they couldn't really sit down. And if they sat down when they got in, they probably couldn't get up. And they couldn't get to the barrel that was in the middle, which was there in order to relieve them, to allow them a space to relieve themselves. And even if they could get to it, would you relieve yourself in public over a barrel? And by the time you finally had no choice, because you thought any hour maybe they'd stop, and so you held out, and by the time you got there, it was disgusting. And he's telling us all this, and I'm just thinking, like, I'm stuck in a cattle car. it's like 15 or 20 minutes where you're not in control. And it suddenly hit me. Just so lost. You've lost control of your life. All the things, you know, Cheryl Mandel mentioned that this afternoon, all the things that you can normally do that allow you to be in control, you lose. And I want to tell you something. Even in the most difficult experiences I had in the army, in combat and terrorists and all this stuff, in the back of your head, you're in control. You decide to run up that hill, and if you really want to hide, you can hide. You'll pay a price for it later. But not there. You are totally lost. You have no control of your life. And to some degree, that is what happens to Esther. Is Esther really in control? Now let's take a look at who Esther is. Esther's name really fits her. She is the hidden one. She has no say in what happens to her. You don't even hear her speak. In fact, she's ordered by Mordechai not to speak. She's out of control. And when I say out of control, I mean life is taking her where it's going to go, and there's nothing she can do about it. She's an orphan. And Mordechai takes her in, right? B'mot avia ve'ima lekacha Mordechai lo levat. It's a whole discussion what exactly the relationship between Mordechai and Esther is. It's a fascinating discussion, but not for now. She lost her parents. And there are a couple people in this room who understand this on a deeper level than I ever will, Baruch Hashem. But I imagine when you lose someone you love in your life, you realize you don't really control things in this world. And if you're an orphan at a young age, girl, then you have no control. Life has just taken you in a totally different direction. And the next thing, Achashverosh, you know, he's at a party, he gets drunk, we all know the story, he calls his wife, she doesn't want to come, so off with her head. Then he wakes up the next morning, and he's executed Vashti, the queen. He's like, whoa, what did I do? We got a problem here, right? Because I killed my wife. It's a problem. And if you look at the Megillah, the problem isn't that I killed my wife, the problem is the king needs a wife. Got to find another one. Okay, find another one. So, what are the two conditions? Who gets to enter the contest for becoming the king's wife? There's one you want to win. Two conditions. You have to be ephemeral. You have to be beautiful. And you have to be a virgin. Those are your two conditions. Now, you're a Jewish girl. Nach, put aside for the moment how you deal with the question of if Esther's actually married to Mordechai, how is she a betulah? Leave that aside. It's an interesting question for another time. Okay? But Esther is a Jewish girl. What do you do if you're a Jewish girl and you're living in Persia and they announce that they're collecting pretty orphan girls to put them in the palace to see if they'll become queen? Queen. Okay? What does it mean to be a queen? So for the thousands of women who go, it means you have a remote chance of actually being the queen. More likely, you're going to spend one night with the king, and once you're used, you're used. You go to the next house, not the house of Chegai, and that's where you stay. You're part of the harem. Anybody know what the Megillah calls the woman who has slept once with the king because he's trying her out? Pilegesh. She called her Pilegesh. Pilegesh isn't quite a wife. You can't take the Pilegesh of the king, the concubine of the king, and ever be with anyone else. So they're enslaved forever. And even if you win the contest, then you're the queen. Then you get the pleasure of going through this Achashverosh whenever he wants. So no Jewish girl is interested in this. So what does the pasuk say? It says, Vatilakach Esther el Beit HaMelech el Yad Hegai Shomer Anashim. Esther gets taken. She's just around, so they take her. Which itself is interesting. Like, why don't you hide her? She gets taken. What does Mordechai do about this? That is the correct answer. Nothing. She's taken into the palace. Right? And she doesn't say who she is. Why doesn't she say who she is? Because Mordechai tells her not to. Listen to this pasuk. V'lo yigida Esther et ha-mavet molada, ki Mordechai tziva le'asher lo tagid. Because Mordechai has commanded her not to say. In other words, who is she? She does what Mordechai says. She gets taken. She's not proactive. She's not even reactive. She's just inactive. Okay? So Mordechai is going to check out on her, but what is she doing? What will happen to her? What will be done to her? She's not a doer, she's a done too. This is the most unlikely heroine you can imagine. And when it finally comes her turn, what will happen to the girl whose turn is? They're in the house of Hegai for 6 months, or possibly 12. But then once the king tries her, then they go to Sheshgaz. That's a different house. That's the you're done. You're the hamburger someone took a bite out of. It's not, you know, what you want to throw away, because it's a good hamburger, but nobody else is going to eat it. You can't sell it. So you just stay in the house there. You can let your imagination wonder what happens to all these thousands of beautiful women in the harem of the king. They're not there to teach Sunday school. This is Esther. This is our heroine. Kim chafetz ba'amelech. And what does she do? So that's an interesting question. Do you want to be the pilegesh stuck there forever? Or if you're already there, do you want to actually win? Like, which is better? To be the concubine, you know, in the SS brothel, or to at least be the queen? So I would imagine, if you're going to do it, at least if you're going to be there, be the queen. You'll have some power, you'll have servants. So figure it out. What does Esther do? Esther does absolutely nothing. Lo biksha davar. Ki im et asher yamer hagai svis amelech shomer nashim. She'll do whatever Hegai says. Hegai says, what can I do for you? You want the cherry gloss or the almond blossom? I don't know. Whatever you want. Well, do you want this type of cream or that? I don't know. Whatever you want. Esther is just, she's the coat hook you hang your hat on. She's not even there. She's hidden. So, vatilakach Esther alamelech. It doesn't say bagia Torah when a turn comes. It doesn't say she goes, she's taken. She is the definition of the one who is taken. Now, of course, for two reasons. First of all, because Hashem runs the world, and this is what's meant to be. And secondly, because when everybody's coming trying to get your attention, sometimes you're interested in the one who doesn't want to get your attention, and that's what happens here. So, it doesn't explain it. There's no long courtship. There's no drama. Vayahave melech et Esther. The king wants Esther. He likes Esther. Somebody to give something to, because she's nothing. So, vatisachen v'chesed lefanav, mikol ha-betulot, vayasem ketem achut b'rosha v'yem lechet, tachat vashti. So he puts the crown on her head, and he crowns her. She does nothing. She doesn't even step up as queen. She's just the queened one. Right? That's who Esther is. And again it says, in Perek Bet Pasuk Chaf, Ein Esther Mageret Malata Vetama. She doesn't say who she is. Because she's the hidden one. Kasher Tziva Lea Mordechai. Vet Mamar Mordechai Esther Osa. Kasher Aitabom Naito. She doesn't say it, not because she doesn't want to say it, not because she's smart, not because she has a strategy, because that's what Mordechai says. And whatever Mordechai says, Esther does. And the Megillah makes a point of saying this. She is the hidden one. So, and by the way, here's an interesting one. Then there's this little mini story. And it's so mini, it's like one verse. And you barely notice it. Right? Two verses. By Mimahaim, Mordechai Yoshev Bishar Melech, Mordechai sitting in the gate. Katzaf Bigtan Viteresh Shnei Yisrael Melech Mishomri Asaf. So Bigtan and Teresh, these two ministers, wherever they are, and they plan to assassinate the king, right? We all know the story. Vayivada Davar LeMordechai. Mordechai finds out about this. He overhears them, he knows the language, whatever it is. So what does he do? He tells Esther, Vayaged LeEsther Hamalka. Vatomer Esther LaMelech B'Shem Mordechai. So Esther tells the king in the name of Mordechai. So a few of us were learning last night, pointed out, this is a little bit interesting. Mordechai tells Esther, so Esther tells the king. Now there are two things interesting about this. The first thing that is interesting about this is that later on, when you look in Perek Vav, Balayla hu nadad ashnat ha-melech, the king can't sleep, we all know the story, and he calls for them to bring the books all about Persian history. So if you're an Achashverosh, and you can read centuries of Persian history, what interests you the most? The story of Achashverosh. So he's reading about himself. It's good reading. Look at me. Look what I did. Right? And then he comes across this story. Vayimatzei katuv asher higid Mordechai al Bigtan v'teresh. He hears about how Mordechai said about Bigtan v'teresh, they're going to kill him. Vayomer melech, ma nasa yakar dula l'Mordechai al zeh. What was done to Mordechai? What's missing here?
Esther.
Like, she comes forward. She's not mentioned. She's the non-person. By the way, as an aside, I don't know if we're going to get to this. What's the problem with this? You want to tell us what the problem with this is?
How did she approach the king?
Yeah. Remember later there's this whole story, she can't go talk to the king, because if she goes talk to the king and the king doesn't want her, she's going to get killed. Here it just says, Vatoma the Melech. She says the Melech. So how does that work? So, you know, maybe they just don't tell the whole story. If the Megillah, if she really has to do this whole fasting and whatever else is going on, and the king sticks out his scepter, just like what happens later on, so then the Megillah doesn't tell us because it doesn't want us to focus on Esther, maybe. Or maybe somehow Esther tells the king. Strange. Strange. But okay. Esther is not the important one here. It's all about Mordechai. Mordechai saves the day. And you see this through the Megillah. And yet Esther, it's Megillah Esther. She's the heroine. And by the way, since we're on the topic, so something happens here. Because Esther starts out the Megillah as nothing. And she finishes the Megillah as everything. Everything. Lech kanos et kol ha-yudim. Go gather all the Jews. Asher b'shushan ha-birah. Tell them to fast for 3 days. I'm going to go talk to the king. And then she talks to the king and she says, can we have a feast? I'm going to make a party. Will you bring Haman? Haman is the second most important person in the entire realm. Esther, the same woman who can't approach the king because she might be killed, who's hiding who she is, all of a sudden says, I need to talk to you guys. He's like, okay. So they get together. But for whatever the reason, which is not for now, it's not the right setting. She's still got to finish setting it up. So she says, I want to make a big party. Can we do this again tomorrow? Like, sure. She's doing it again tomorrow. And then they get together. And she all of a sudden comes out of her shell. There's a people and they're being destroyed. And it's my people and they're going to be shechted. Who's doing this? Ish sarvo yev haman arshaze. This is Haman. Unbelievable. The meek wallflower stands up and becomes Wonder Woman. Unbelievable. And then she's sending scrolls. And now the Megillah ends before we end with Mordechai. Right? Who is the one who tells everyone what to do? You know the story of Shushan? How come we have two different days? Why can we have two different days?
Esther asked for an extra day.
Because Esther asked for an extra day. We killed about 400 people in Shushan. The king could have said, okay, that's it. Esther goes to Ahasuerus, and he says, we need another day. We haven't killed enough Persians. There's still more left. Can you imagine? Can you imagine, right, that Democrats and Republicans all get together, and they're in Louisiana and Kentucky, and they've surrounded Jewish villages. And the police are corrupt. So Trump gives his permission for the Jews to fight back. And then Ivanka goes to Trump and says, we need another day. We haven't killed enough rednecks. That's ridiculous. And that's what Esther does. And the king says, sure. And then at the end of the Megillah, right? And by the way, look what happens here. If you look carefully at these words, right? Vatasem Esther et Mordechai al Beit Haman. Esther appoints Mordechai now. It's completely reversed. Vatosef Esther v'daber lifnei ha-melech. Second, I apologize. Vayomer ha-melech le-Esther ha-malka. She becomes the queen here. Vatichtov Esther Malka Beit Avichayel Mordechai Yudi and Kol Tokef Lekayem Et Kol HaIgeret HaPurim Hazot. Right? Esther is the one, and Mordechai is mentioned second, who writes the letter that says that this is what we're going to do, and we're going to keep this festival, we're going to fast, and we're going to Mishloach Manot. It's all comes from Esther. Lekayem Et Yemei HaPurim Ha'ele. כאשר קיים עליהם מרדכי יהודי ואסתר המלכה.
And what does Esther say to Mordechai? She says, "Vatitzavet Mordechai." She commands Mordechai. So the commanded becomes the commander. How does that happen?
So I was in this big, I don't know what you call it. They call it Sinai Indaba. Indaba is some kind of African word for like, we all gather and have a kumsitz. I don't know. It's a cool name. We can Indaba together by the Kotel sometime, right? And it's a longer story. I'm still not quite sure exactly what I was doing there, but it was an amazing experience.
And 5,000 Jews, they all came together in this big conference center, this one room, and they just learned Torah. It was unbelievable. They had jam sessions, and kids were there. It was really mind-boggling. And when you think about 5,000 Jews in South Africa, I mean, in Johannesburg has 50,000 Jews. So that's 10% of the city. New York City has about 3.3 million Jews. Right? That would be 350,000 Jews getting together. That's unbelievable. Right? And I they asked me to give a couple classes, and I thought there'd be like 30, 40 people in the class, because you know, when you go to a Peach Conference or a Birthday Conference, that's what it is. There's 40 teachers, they split these rooms. Here they had four halls. I show up, there's like 1,000 people in the room, right? So one of the guys who spoke there on the first night, a guy named Charlie Harari, maybe some of you have heard the name. Great stuff. Oh, you heard him? You met him? Yeah? Oh, good for you. So he's a fantastic guy, and he gave a shiur, and he's the one who got me thinking about this question. Never thought about that before. You know, that's what I love about Torah. You can always come up with a new perspective. And he said, like, what happened to Esther? How did Esther turn it around? So there's a moment. And this moment changes everything. And I want you to understand that one of the messages of the Megillah is that life presents you with certain moments. And when they come along, you have to grab them. You have to grab them. You know? There are moments like that in your life. I remember when I was a kid. I was in, I don't know, 6th or 7th grade. I don't remember exactly. And New York City in the 1970s was like murder capital of the world. I can't tell you how many times I got mugged by the time I was 15 years old. And everybody in my class said, everybody got mugged. It wasn't a question of whether you got mugged. It was like, what kind of mugging did you have? Did they take your money? Did they beat you? Let's see. Aha, one black guy. Check this out. Everybody got mugged. And it got so if you were white and Jewish, you were like nervous to walk around. You know, like you didn't go to Central Park at night because, you know, they'd kill you, right? And today it's not like that, Baruch Hashem, but back then it was. And I remember one Sunday, my older brother and I, we were going for a bike ride. You know, out Sunday, bike ride and having a good time. And we're biking up Broadway. And, you know, slow down for a light. And all of a sudden there's like 15 kids and they surround us. You know, and they're like, you know, African Americans, black. Back then we called them blacks, but whatever. And oh, okay, we're not going to get into the PC world some other time. It's actually a problem. I went to speak at Wits University years ago, which is the a university in Johannesburg, South Africa. And it was a year after liberation. It was a year after apartheid fell. It was a very powerful time to be there. It was incredibly inspiring. And I went to this university, and for the first time, there were blacks and whites, and they were in the same room. It was really powerful. And I wanted to tell them. They asked me to give a shiur, and they invited all their friends. And so their blacks showed up, whites showed up. It was amazing. And I was so moved because of what they had experienced under apartheid, the real apartheid, not the one they're, you know. And I'm trying to say, you know, it's so amazing that you're sitting here, you know, whites, Jews. And then I'm like, oh, no, but what do I was going to say African-Americans, but I'm in Africa. So I was going to say Africans, but I realized, well, everybody's Africans. You're white Africans, black Africans. Then I was going to say black Africans, but that sounded wrong, right? And finally I said, you know, I don't know quite what to say, because if I was in America, I would say African-Americans. But you're just Africans, but, like, how do you say you're white and you're... So if somebody goes out, we're black. And I said, oh, that's it. Okay, fine. Right? We're allowed to say that here, right? So, yeah. We're going to erase this tape, but okay. But it was very moving. It was very moving because it shouldn't matter whether you're white or black, obviously. And so there's a group of kids and they're surrounded us. It doesn't matter what color they are. And I remember a couple of kids grab this handlebar and a couple of kids the other, and they're grabbing my bike. And I'm like, I don't know, what's like 12, 13? And my brother was like a little older. He was like 14, 15. And there's 15 kids around. There's two white Jewish kids on our bicycles. And we realize that they're trying to steer us off of Broadway onto some side street. So my brother, who's sharper than I am at this point, says,
you know, don't let them take you down like the side street, because it'll be bad. We got to stay on Broadway, right? So we're trying to resist them and not get off Broadway, because Broadway has lots of people. It's Sunday, you know, whatever. And if we go on the side, who knows? They'll take our bikes. Who knows what they're going to do? And eventually, you know, they're pulling us aside. We managed to make a U-turn. And this group of kids is, like, surrounding us. And I'll never forget this. This big guy, this big white guy, is out for a run. And I guess he figured out something was wrong, because a white Jewish boy with tzitzis and payas is hanging out with a bunch of black kids trying to take his bike. Like, oh, this is not a normal scenario. So he realized what's going on. And he looks at them and he goes, what's the matter with you kids? Get out of here. And he comes over and he's a big guy. So they kind of let go and we're a little surprised. So my brother, like, says to me in Hebrew, yalla, yalla, you know, whatever, right? And off we go. And we manage to get away. And the next thing I know, they're running after us, but we're biking, and I turn into an Olympic biker, right? Like, it was unbelievable. I could hear them, and I turn around at one point, and I see them running after me. I know if they catch me, it's going to be Benny Friedman pudding. It's going to be bad. And we managed to get away. And we turned a corner, and we got home, and we're like breathing, whatever it is, right? Like, we're saved. And I remember that moment for me was, it was a seminal moment. I realized I'm tired of being scared. And you can't even ride on Broadway. And I had a friend who'd been pushing me, because he also got mugged a couple times too many. He started going to karate, Toro Dojo. And he said, you got to come. And so finally I said, okay, I'm going to go and try this out. And that's when I started going to karate, got into martial arts. I think that's probably what led me to decide eventually to stay in Israel and go to the army, which definitely changed my life. But if I had to look back, and I only think of this moment because somebody once asked me this question, I think that moment presented itself as a window of opportunity. Like, I had a chance, I had a ratzon, to just decide to change the direction of my life. And you get these opportunities in life. And the funny thing is, I had no idea that was a significant decision. I was just going to try some class on a Wednesday night. We don't always recognize that we're in that moment when we're in that moment. Now, we're almost done, but I want you to understand this. Think about this. Mordechai comes to the palace, and he's in sackcloth. Haman has decreed, this is now back to Perek Dalet, the fourth chapter. Haman has decreed, right? There's this terror, there's a split up, and then all the, they're like a virus, they're vermin. When we go to Yad Vashem, on Yom HaShoah, the Holocaust Memorial Museum, we'll stand in the entrance at the beginning of the museum, and you'll see that the first exhibit is how can a civilization, how can a society reach a point where it allows human beings to be put into cattle cars and burned and turned into fertilizer? The Nazis spent a decade transforming us from being human beings to being vermin. It's exactly what Haman does. They're just this, they're vermin. Gotta get rid of them. So we're gonna pick a day. And we're gonna throw the lots, and the lots come out on this day. And for whatever the reason, for the drush and the Gemara, Haman decides it's a good day, we're going to shech them all in one day. This is not just a Holocaust. This is not 6 million over 6 years. This is 18 million in one day. Everywhere, it's going to be kill the Jew day. And Mordechai is devastated. He's devastated. And he tears his clothing. By the way, it's an interesting question. One of the commentaries points out, when do you do Kriya? When do you tear your clothes? After what? After the tragedy. You tear your clothes because someone died. There's nothing you can do anymore. It's torn. But here, no one's died yet. What are you supposed to do when this kind of thing happens? You're supposed to get together and daven. Who figures that out? Esther, lech kanos et kol ha'yudim. Why is Moshe tearing his clothes? Moshe tearing his clothes is symbolic of the idea that there's something happening here that cannot be fixed. Hashem is sending a message that you don't belong in Persia. And the Jews are so immersed in Persia that they don't get it. Now, I'm not a prophet of doom, and I don't believe there's a Holocaust around the corner, and I don't think there are going to be pogroms in St. Louis next week. But anybody who thinks that there's some kind of guarantee that the Jews in America or England or France or anywhere in the world today besides Israel are guaranteed to survive as a community... My kids like to call this a person who's chai b'seret, are living in a different movie. And that's the message of the Megillah. So Mordechai's tearing up his clothes, he's wearing sackcloth, and he gets to the palace. And somehow Esther doesn't know about this, which is unbelievable. She doesn't know about this. That's what it seems.
If she does know about it, it's even worse. So let's give her the benefit of the doubt and assume she doesn't know about this. So he comes in sackcloth. He's unkempt. He's in mourning. She's embarrassed by him. So she sends a tach, or her servant rather, to go and fix him up. And this Mordechai, right? Vatikra Esther la'atach. Sorry. Uvechol medina medina. This is Perek Dalet. Asher Dvar HaMelech V'Dato Magia, where the word of the king is reached. Evel Gadol LeYehudim. Tzom Uvchi U'Mispad Sak Va'Efa Yitzal Rabim. The Jews are in mourning. They're fasting. They're crying. They're in agony. They're wearing sackcloth. And Vatavona and the Ne'arot Esther, the Sariseh, her servants come, and they tell her that Mordechai has come to the palace, and that he's wearing sackcloth. I guess she knows, or they know, that there's a connection. How do they know there's a connection between Mordechai and Esther? Pardon? Yeah, but how do they know that he's... No, because he's the one who sends word about Big Dan and Teresh. There's already an established connection. So she's very upset about this. Vatishlach begadim lahalbishet Mordechai lasir sako me'alav. So what does she do? The Jewish people are about to be slaughtered. The decree has been made in the palace. She's upset because he's not wearing his suit. Are you getting this? This is crazy. So he doesn't want to take this. That's not... What's the matter with you? Vatikra Esther la'atach. So she calls another servant. Whoever Atach is, Daniel, whoever. Vatitzaveyu al Mordechai. So she tells him. Now this is interesting. This is the first time that we find that Esther's giving orders. She's not now taking orders from Mordechai. She's not taking orders from Haggai. She's not being taken to the queen. She's becoming a queen. I wonder if Mordechai needs to be a queen, if Esther needs to be a queen, so that she will learn how to be the person who controls her own destiny instead of having her destiny controlled for her. Maybe. Ladat mazeh v'al mazeh. What's going on? So he goes out to Mordechai. V'agid lo Mordechai et kol asher kara. And Mordechai tells him everything that's going on. V'pachegin k'tav adat. And the whole letter that went out. And the decree of death. U'lagid la u'latzavot aleha lavo al ha'melech l'itchanen lo l'vakesh milfanav alama. So he says to her, you have to go and beg for the Jewish people. That's why you're there. Now this is the most unbelievable point of the entire Megillah. Any servant who goes to the king and is not called for will be killed, because the king was afraid of assassins or whatever else is going on. Unless he stretches out his golden scepter. What does that mean? It means I can't do this. I can't do this. I'll be put to death. I haven't been called for 30 days. That's her answer. If you had to pick two words to define that answer, what would you say they are? Esther says, who, me? What do you want from me? I don't know what to do. That's unbelievable. And the next minute, Esther's going to change everything. How does that happen? So here's how that happens. Vayomer Mordechai la'ashiva Esther. By the way, Mordechai doesn't say this to Esther directly. Mordechai just passes along this message. Esther has time to think about this. Al tedami benafshech limaled bet ha'melech mikol ha'yudim. Don't think that because you're in the palace, you're going to be fine. That's a really powerful line. That's a really powerful line. There were plenty of Jews in Germany who just didn't think it could happen to them. You know why? Because they were Germans. They fought in World War I. They supported Beethoven. They were members of the Philharmonic. They were Germans. They didn't even know they were Jewish. They didn't even marry Jewish. Al tedami benafshech. Anachnu am echad. Ki im acharish tachrishi beit hazot, if you will be silent in this moment, then salvation will come to the Jews from somewhere else and you will be lost forever. Now I want you to understand something. Mordechai in this moment is the worst salesman in history.
What does Mordechai say to Esther? Listen, dude, if you don't save the Jews, somebody else will. Like, that's not what you're supposed to say. You're supposed to say, if you don't save the Jews, we're all going to be slaughtered. Ah! That's what Mordechai says. He says, if you don't save the Jews, somebody else will. And you'll lose it. What does that mean? Don't make the mistake of thinking that the Jewish people is dependent on whether you save the Jewish people. The Jewish people will be saved. You know how I know the Jewish people will be saved? Because Hashem says the Jewish people will be saved. Anybody who thinks that you go to the army because otherwise the Jews will be destroyed is missing the point completely. I didn't go to the army because I thought if I don't go to the army, the Jewish people are in danger. The Jewish people are not in danger. Iran can build a nuclear missile. They can shoot a nuclear missile. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will decide where it falls. You know, maybe it'll miss where they're aiming. It'll land on the Golden Dome. And Yishtabach Shemo, we'll figure it out from there. I don't know. That's not why you go to the army. That's not why you go to college. That's not why you don't go because you're going to save the Jewish people. The Jewish people doesn't need your saving. HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the Jewish people. You go because you have an opportunity to be a part of that story. Because you can play a role in the play. And if you don't seize this moment, then you'll be lost forever. You missed your moment. There's nothing sadder than a person missing their moment. We can debate whether if they missed their moment, they were meant to miss their moment. That's a theological discussion. And then Mordechai says something else. Now, there are two powerful things in that line. Who knows but for this moment you arrive in the palace? First is the fact that Mordechai says, who knows? This is not the kind of language we're used to hearing in Tanakh. Usually the Navi says, this is it. Mordechai doesn't know. Mordechai's walking out of the palace, Liot Mashlom Aster. He doesn't know. Like, what is this? What just happened here? What are we doing here? You know, you find yourself in the middle of Africa for Shabbos, and you know what you're doing there. And you're not sure. Mordechai has no idea. Doesn't know why he's there. He's not sure. But he sees that she's chosen. It cannot be a coincidence that a Jew is now the queen. We got to see what happens here. And he says to her, this is your moment. This is why Hashem put you in this spot. But it's your moment if you make it your moment. Because if you don't make it your moment, it'll be someone else's moment, but it won't be yours. And Hashem put you in this world to be better than that. We love to live in the world of mediocrity. We do. We love to be comfortable. But sometimes you got to step out of your comfort zone. You got to be willing to go in and walk yourself into the king. And it's fascinating what happens. Lech kanos et kol yudim. Okay, here's what you're going to do. The whole world changes now. Mordechai now goes and does everything Esther commands him to do. She takes control. You want to know why this is called Megillat Esther? Because it's no big deal for a Mordechai to change the world. Mordechai is an Ish Yemini. He's Ben Kish. He comes from the family of Shaul HaMelech. He's royalty. He's on the Sanhedrin. He's a leader. But Esther is the Miskite par excellence. She's the wallflower. She's the orphan. She has no self-confidence. She's taken by life. And one day she has a moment and she gets to decide whether she will take control of her life. You know? Are you living a life of mediocrity? Or do you dare? Do you dare to climb the ladder and reach greatness? That's why it's called Megillat Esther. Because the hiddenness has to be remembered. Because there's a light. It's true on a personal level. On a personal level, each of us carries this incredible light. We're created B'Tselem Elokim. We're part of the greatest generation in the history of the Jewish people. We're living the stuff of dreams. Our ancestors would have imagined that we were Mashiach, each one of us. I live here. I teach Torah in the old city of Yerushalayim. I speak Hebrew. I served in the Jewish army. I must be Mashiach. It's crazy. We don't appreciate how blessed we are. Do we grab that? And what's true on an individual level is even more true on a national level. The Jewish people are living in incredible times. Now, I don't want you to misunderstand. I don't, and I don't think we should ever. I don't judge individuals. It's not for me to say whether a person should go to the army, not go to the army. Whether a person should make aliyah, not make aliyah.
There are lots of people who live in Chutz La'aretz and in America and England and South Africa and Australia, and they live there for good reasons, and they have difficulties making a living, and they have loved ones that are ill, and there's a million reasons why a person stays overseas, and I happen to be blessed not to have been burdened by those challenges. I don't judge any individual. God forbid. I do think every one of us, and particularly every one of you in this room, has to struggle with the question. You make your own decision, you live your life, you ask yourself what you really want, you ask yourself why you want it, and you ask yourself if you think Hashem wants you to want this. And if anybody tells you that they know what Hashem wants you to want, unless the halacha is clear, which is not here, you can send them to me. I don't know what Hashem wants sometimes. I know we have to struggle with the question. You have to struggle with the question. But that's on a micro, on a macro level. That the Jewish people, after 2,000 years of dreaming, have finally come home, that we have a state to call our own, that we have an opportunity to influence the outcome of the most magnificent experiment in modern times. That you get to be here, that the Jewish people in its entirety is not getting up and coming home, that's scary. If there was ever a window of opportunity that is closing and that we're missing, it is this window. And that's the challenge of Purim. You know, Purim is not quite the Chag, right? We don't have quite the Suda. And we don't say Hallel. There's something missing. Purim doesn't quite get there. You know why Purim doesn't get there? You know what the big problem on Purim is? Purim starts in Galut and it ends in Galut. Does anybody know what was happening historically during this period of time of Shushan and Purim and Mordechai? Does anybody know what was happening in Israel?
Ezra and the others were coming back to Israel starting to rebuild.
You're close. You're close. Nehemiah and Zerubbabel were here. Ezra's coming back. Ezra comes back after the Beit HaMikdash is built. Yeah. At the very least, the Beit HaMikdash was being built. Koresh, Cyrus's decree that the Jews could come home, had definitely already taken place. The only question is the Beit HaMikdash built yet? Do you understand this? Koresh says you can go home. You can go home. They're building a Beit HaMikdash. They're building the temple. And they're in Sudas Purim. They're drinking kelim mi kelim shonim. Believe me, there was no glatt kosher food at the Suda of Achashverosh. And the rabbis have a field day with this. Those of you who learned Masechta Megillah saw this a couple of times, of the juxtaposition. When the Jews are so immersed in the Persian feast days that they're more Persian, the leader of the Jewish people is a guy named Mordechai. Do you know where Mordechai comes from? The name Mordechai is a Persian name. It comes from the word Marduch. Marduch is one of the idolatrous pagan gods of Bavel. This is like, you know, Christian Rabinovich. That's the equivalent. We're stuck in the muck of exile. And we believe in Hashem, and isn't this wonderful? And it's a big party. And then everybody has a big parade, and then they go back to living in Galut. And you don't have to go back 2,500 years to see this. You can see it on the news every day. You can look around us. Most of the Jewish world has not yet come home. So again, I'm not judging individuals. And we as individuals, each of us have to struggle with this question. But as a bigger picture, Am Yisrael could be coming home and we're not. And that should challenge us. I sometimes think that's why people get drunk on Purim, because it's a little depressing when you stop to think about it. But on a deeper level, we get to discover the light that's inside of us. There's something beautiful hidden very often inside each one of us. And this is the opportunity to discover what that's all about. You know? To let yourself be revealed. And I'll finish with one last thought. You know, there is a custom halacha discussion. I know you had a panel on this last night that we drink on Purim. And the Gemara says, Chayavin ish l'masubei b'furaya, a person is supposed to drink on Purim. Ad lo yada ben ar Mordechai whatever, right? I'm not there yet, but that's what it's supposed to sound like, right? Is it Mordechai that's cursed? Is it Haman that's cursed? So I will tell you two things. Okay? I'll tell you one thing. We'll leave another thing for the Suda. But what does that mean? How could Judaism want me to get drunk? So, what does it mean, ad lo yada? So some people say, ad lo yada, and that's what's really means, lo yada. Okay, briskers, they try to find a way out. The Hasidim will say it's very simple. We get too stuck in what we think we know. Sometimes you got to get beyond what you know. You know? 364 days a year, you're not supposed to drink. You're not supposed to get drunk. And if you get drunk, something's wrong. One day a year, you get to find out what's inside of you. You know? The Gemara says, Nichnas Yayin Yotzei Sod. When a person drinks, the secrets come out. If you think you're proud of what comes out of you when you have a little too much to drink, You know, I get together with my friends on Purim, and we get a little imbibed, and my kids make fun of it, because we all start getting very lovey-dovey and hugging each other, and I love you, man, and it's so beautiful, whatever. If that's what comes out of you, I was once present when Rav Lichtenstein must have been machmer himself that year and drank a little too much wine, and he got drunk. He was sitting on a chair in the middle of a circle, and they were dancing, okay? And he started mumbling. And I think, oh my God, this is unbelievable. Like, Rav Lichtenstein is drunk and he's mumbling. I got to hear what he's saying. So I run into the circle, right? Which I would never have had the guts to do if it was a normal day. But I run into the circle and put my up to his ear. And he did not drink. He was not into, even an Abdullah, he would take a sip and give it to someone else. But for some reason, it seemed to me he was drunk. I don't know, maybe I was wrong. And he's mumbling, right? And I couldn't understand half of what he was saying. But he was saying something like, he was just spewing Torah. Like that what was inside of him. So if you're at the level where you could spew Torah like that, then by all means drink and pray. If that's not where you're at, my advice is take the Rambam's way out, grab a shluff. But this is the day to take a pause and ask ourselves, who are we really? And do we find the moment in our lives and seize it? And make it real so that we can discover the light within us, because the world needs that light. It should be a frail from Purim for everybody. That's a shame.